Hello, I'm Sian Kane. Before you get started with this edition of the Books Podcast, we want to point you in the direction of our sponsor, Squarespace. For everything you need to set your website apart, head to squarespace.com/guardian to get 10% off your first purchase. And now, on with the show.
The Guardian.
According to neuroscientists, when we stir up a long-term memory, it floats in our consciousness, unstable, for a window of approximately 3 hours. During this time, the memory is malleable. The present infiltrates the past. We add details to fill in the gaps. Then the brain re-encodes the memory as if it were new, writing over the old one. As it sinks back down into the depths of our minds, we are not even aware of what we have gained or lost or why. Pure memories are like dinosaur bones, one neuroscientist wrote. Discrete fragments from which we compose the image of the dinosaur. They are only flashes, the examining room table in the nurse's office, the soft hand against the forehead. But memories we tell as stories come alive. Tendons join the bones, muscles and fat and skin fill them out. And when we look again, our memories are whole, breathing creatures that roam our past.
Hello, and welcome to the Guardian Books podcast. This week we dive into memory for an investigation of the stories we tell ourselves, the way they shape who we are, who we become, and who we want to be. One of the powers of writing the past and sealing it for all time in the pages of a book is that you can commit yourself to a particular version of history. You can choose your own hero, your own perspective, and your own ending, which might diverge from someone else's, but this isn't necessarily as problematic as it sounds.
There are memories that can be honest without being true.
We begin with a man who must wish a lot of his memories weren't true, though he has made brave and honest use of them over a 20-year writing career, which has culminated this autumn in his first major award. Much of Alex Wheatle's childhood was spent in a South London children's home, an experience that informed his well-received debut novel Brixton Rock in 1999. 5 novels followed that, including one set in the Brixton riots, his own involvement in which led to Alex being briefly and life-changingly jailed. But it was turning to YA, young adult fiction, with his Cronkton trilogy that has set him on a new path, creating a new language, a new history, and a whole new landscape bursting with edgy young characters, like chubby 14-year-old Mackay, his best friend Little Bit, aka Bit, and the lovely Venetia. Alex joined Claire in the studio to talk about Cronkton Nights and how and why he translates his life experience and memory into fiction. But let's begin by hearing the moment when the previous year's Guardian Children's Fiction Prize winner David Armand made the announcement.
I'm delighted and privileged to say that the winner of the Guardian Children's Fiction Prize this year is Cronkton Nights by Alex Wheatley.
Oh my gosh. I don't know what to say. I think I will say this. I'm a product of the public library service because I wasn't that much educated. As a kid, you know, when I left school, I had nothing. I had no O-levels, not even CSEs, you know, but I educated myself in a public library, in Brixton Library, the Tate Library, in Windrush Square. That is where I did my reading, that is where I did my education. And it makes me cry that so many libraries have been closed all over the country. So if anything, this is an award for the library. It really is. Thank you very much.
So we've just stepped outside of the prize room. We've got Alex Wheatle. How are you feeling? You've processed it a bit?
Excited. Just honoured.
Yeah.
Just honoured that, you know, someone like a legend like David Armand can present me that prize. Just, I can't tell you how overwhelming that is, especially as, from what I believe, correct me if I'm wrong, I think I'm the first black writer to win this award. I think that's correct. I'm not sure. If you can check it out, maybe.
I'm pretty sure, because I think Mallory Blackman hasn't won it yet.
So to be that, and Mallory was inspiration to me because, you know, she's always there, sometimes fighting a lone battle, but there's a few of us joining her now. So for me to receive this award is just amazing because I know of the winners who have come before. It's such
great pillars of great British writing. And for me to join that is mind-boggling. It just, I can't get around it. It's going to freak me out for days, weeks. It's amazing. I mean, as I said in my acceptance speech, if I made any sense, the children's writing is, I think, on a different level to anything else right now. So for me to be even amongst that elite, fantastic group is fantastic. It really is.
As you can hear there, Alex Wheatle was a genuinely surprised winner of a prize, which doesn't happen that often because people do often get tipped off. Alex, this was unexpected for you.
Yes, it was. I just thought that, I better show my face because it's such a marvellous award, but I wasn't expecting to really win it. I mean, I just came off the plane from Jamaica, so I was really tired. My wife went straight to bed. So she, in fact, after the award announcement, I tried to call her and she was still sleeping. You know, I had to surprise her later on with a bottle of champagne. She got up for that. But it was mad crazy. I mean, I think someone told me that in the past, winners had been tipped off. But no, I wasn't. So you guys really kept this from me. You know?
And it was for Cronkton Nights, which is the second in a trilogy set on South Cronkton Estate, fictional estate. And the first in the trilogy, Little Bit, was nominated for the Carnegie. You've written, is it 6 books for adults?
That's right, yeah.
So why did you suddenly turn to YA books, which means, for those who don't know, books for young adults?
My adult books were always received very well, but often considered why I wasn't being selected or picked out or invited to all these lovely festivals that we have in the UK. After The Dirty South was published, I kind of spoke to my agent and I said, you know, I've only been invited to one major literary festival in about 10 years. Am I stogging a dead horse here? Do I need to change my genre or do I need to change my approach? Or just even I was considering, am I worthy of this you know, this thing called a writer, if you like. Is it worth carrying on? Because it's such a struggle. You know, it's not easy. You spend many lonely hours, weeks and months to, fine-tune a novel. And I felt that the payback wasn't high enough at that point. So I had a word with my agent and she said, well, maybe you should try young adult fiction because your writing lends towards it. And I thought about it and I have all these stories in my head anyway. And to be honest, Brixton Rock is about a 17, 18-year-old.
That was your first novel, Brixton Rock, was published in
1999. And Dirty South is about an 18-year-old. So really, I'm not going too far back in years. So I thought, maybe I can have a go at this. You know, I had to change my skill set a little bit because writing for children, you have to be more immediate. You have to be more engaging. You can't just rely on a skeleton of a story. I had this idea about creating a fictional town. I didn't want to rely on Brixton anymore. I didn't want to rely on what I knew. And I've travelled quite widely in the UK. I've gone to schools from as far as Plymouth to as far as Edinburgh. And so I took what I could from all those places where I visited, all those issues that young people had, not just in South London, but everywhere in the UK. And I thought maybe I can employ all that for my fictional town. And I wanted it to be diverse. I wanted it to be, I wanted the reader to read along and not to be too sure of what the racial background is of certain characters. Because I didn't want it to be race kind of, I wanted to take the kind of race out of it, if you like. I just wanted it to be a town where that wasn't an issue.
And so your main character, central character in this novel is Mackay, named after, it's obviously a Scottish name.
That's right.
He's mixed race.
Scottish name.
He's
mixed
race.
So, he's got a mixed race mother. And so I thought it just kind of reflects how the UK is today with so many families who have a bit of everything in there.
And you've got Venetia, who's the girl that's the
who's
plot.
The heroine.
She's the heroine, and she was also the heroine in, or the love.
The love interest in
interest
Little Bit.
In Little Bit as well. Everybody desires Venetia. In this, novel, the plot hinges on her losing her phone, and she comes from a religious family, and she has been sexting, and that is really, really bad news.
It's a growing problem, isn't it, today? I attend schools, and apparently one of the number one issues and problems is this sexting phenomenon. And I've heard of stories where girls have to be moved away. You know, parents have to move their families away because the peer pressure gets so bad once something goes viral that they just have to take that poor girl out of school and just move to another school. And that's terrible. And so I thought maybe I could work this into the theme of the novel because it's such a terrible thing to happen to anybody. I mean, even if you're an adult and somebody's sharing inappropriate images of you online, that's terrible for an adult, but for a young girl. And we all know the how young girls are now, how about they're so worried about how they look and, you know, how they're viewed and perceived. And we have so much of young women or young girls at school feeling that they're inadequate, feeling that people are laughing at them, feeling that they're not good enough, feeling that they're not pretty enough. So all those issues play into that. So I thought it was a very important subject matter that I was trying to tackle. And at first, it scared me to death because, you know, I'm not a young girl of 15. So, but I thought it's a worthy subject to try and take forward.
And Venetia is not a passive.
No,
she's not a
I didn't want to make her
all,
passive and just
no.
be, you know, always crying in a corner. I wanted to be active. I wanted her to take a big role. So she's not just led by the guys on this epic adventure. She actually plays a big part. Well, I don't want to spoil the ending, but, you know, she's not a damsel in distress, shall we say. Gloria Richardson House was four stories high and about the length of a football pitch. There were no lifts. Led by bit, we started to climb the steep concrete steps leading to the upper floors. My heart started to pound again, and not just because I wasn't exactly in gold medal shape. This was proper scary now. When we reached the second floor, Bit stopped. "Everyone good?" he asked. Me and Jonah nodded yes, but what we both meant was, "Are you crazy? Of course not." Syrah linked arms with Venetia and said, "Course." She was one brave chick. My heart even stopped drumming for a second. I took in a big gulp of air. Venetia didn't answer. She simply stepped ahead of us, made her way along the balcony. She moved like an Olympic gymnast, graceful. Her trainers didn't make a squeak. We followed in single file. I started to flex my fingers. Bit crunched his fingers into fists. A car revved in a forecourt. I caught a whiff of someone nearby cooking fish. Reggae music was playing from one of the flats above. We had almost reached the end of the balcony when Venetia slowed down, stopped outside a blue door, closed her eyes, breathed in, breathed out, and said, "We're here." "You still want to do this?" asked Syrah. Venetia nodded. "Step back a bit," she advised. "I'm going to ask him to give me back my phone on a level. I don't want any drama." "Okay," said Bit. "Of course," said Jonah. We drew back about 3 meters. Venetia slapped the letterbox. She shuffled her feet as she waited. She stretched her fingers. She took in another breath. She said a silent prayer. My insides were flinging custard pies at each other. The reggae music blared out. The bass line was solid. Then there was a noise at the door. The drawbridge opened. "You're here," said a voice with an Italian accent. "So glad you made it. I would have picked you up like usual on my bike." "I'll come for my phone," said Venetia bluntly. "Can we talk first?" said Sergio. "I just wanted to see you again so we can settle things. Please hear me out, V. I'm so sorry." "We're done, Sergio. End of finito. There ain't anything to chat about or to settle. I'm sorry, but just give me back my freaking phone." "Can you just come inside and talk? Let me say sorry properly. We can get through this, V. It will be different from now on. We'll go out more. I'll take you to that theatre place you're always talking about. I'll come to your dance performances. I won't be so, what do you say, demanding." Suddenly, Bit burst forward, barged past Venetia and pushed Sergio back into his castle. "Give V back her phone." Syrah and me rushed in after him. The scene inside was like Rocky 10. Sergio pummeling Bit on the ground, Venetia clawing at Sergio's face.
Now, I'm really interested in the fact that your novels have mostly been narrated by people in their teens,
yeah.
Your adult novels and your children's novels, and particularly in the extent to which your autobiography feeds into them. Now, in Brixton Rock, your hero, in inverted commas, because he was not a heroic figure in many ways, is Brenton, who's a really troubled kid, who's come out of a children's home, the children's home in which you grew up, presumably, isn't
That's
it?
Right,
which
yeah.
is Shirley Oaks.
Yeah,
Children's
I think
Village.
In Brixton Rock, for legal reasons, I called it Spurley Oaks. So I'll give it some kind of different name, or Pinewood Oaks even. And basically all that rage, all that bitterness. What I remember growing up is that I used to plead with social workers and the people around me to try and understand where I'm coming from. In my schooling, sometimes teachers, they just wouldn't have any kind of perception of what my life was like. And so when I came to class in the morning and I was in distress, and they're telling me that I must do my maths, I must do my English, and I'm not in no fit state to even look at the page. And then I was sent out to the headmaster, and the headmaster had a go at me. They said no idea. So I just wanted to get across that feeling of isolation, that feeling of rage, that feeling of anger, of living in that world where adults just don't understand you.
But what is clever about the way you dramatised it is that you don't portray all the authority figures as monsters. The social worker is very long-suffering and it tries his best to be sympathetic to Brenton, but actually he can't.
That is correct.
He can't quite get there.
He can't quite get there because his background kind of stalls him. And he can't get into the mindset of someone like a Brenton Brown. And so there you have that dynamic of someone trying to understand and somebody growing up who's young who just thinks that adults will never understand him. And sometimes in those cases, the friends who I grew up with, because of that feeling that they feel the world is against them, they just go completely the other way, you know, and they might rely on drugs or drinks or they might turn violent and so on. So I just wanted to kind of be that bridgehead where for the reader who doesn't know about these lives can get some kind of understanding of what it's like to live that kind of life.
And you brought Brenton back in another novel, a sequel in 2011, which actually fortuitously was when the Tottenham riots were kicking off.
Yeah.
And he was observing it from the other side, from maturity.
Yeah, it was a question really, because everyone said to me, Alex, you've got to write a follow-up to Brixton Rock. I mean, what happens? You know, what happens to him in his adult life? And so after a few years, I decided, okay, let me tackle that. And again, you know, in my 30s, or even in my late 20s, I still had lots of trauma that I didn't really process. Lots of angst, lots of bitterness, if you like. And even though you try to sometimes push it to the back of your mind, you try to get on with your daily life, but sometimes you find yourself angry and you're not quite sure why. You find yourself kind of, again, pining for this understanding from the people around you. And, you know, I have loved ones around me as well. I've got a family. And sometimes they look at me and they're at a loss of what they can do to kind of cheer me up or make me smile or, you know, I'll get moments like that. And so that was the trigger that, you know, unleashed Brenton Brown again, I think, because I think I wrote it for myself just as much as people wanted to follow up.
And he was a painter and decorator there, and looking, and he is still in South London, but South London has been gentrified, so this introduces a completely new theme.
Yeah, and he's trying to participate in that world that doesn't understand him. Juliet doesn't really get him.
Juliet is very successful, isn't
it? Yes, she is. But even then, she doesn't really understand what's going on in his mind. And again, I'm trying to portray that character who feels isolated in the world he inhabits. Just like me, really, because I felt that many times in my life, in my personal relationships with my children, people around me, that sometimes I'll go off for one, be angry for whatever reason, and they just couldn't understand why.
Just explain his relationship with Juliet.
Well, Brenton grew up alone, and he didn't know of his family. But through his social worker's help, he managed to track his mother down. And then he discovers that he has a half-sister. And the half-sister takes on all the guilt of the mum, so they spend a lot of time together. And then there's this attraction between half-sister and brother. At the time when I wrote the first novel, I wasn't even aware of genetic sexual attraction, you know, GSA. But after I wrote Bricks and Rock, I received many letters describing this phenomenon. And so it happens more often than people think, where siblings who grew up apart, they have this strange attraction, and sometimes it can turn sexual.
But you didn't find this? You didn't have siblings who suddenly turned up?
No, it didn't happen in my experience, no. What happened with me, I tracked my mother down in 2002. I went to the US and met her for the first time. Again, she had this guilt that even now she struggles with because she was forced to give me up.
She had already had a family. She already had four
children. Yeah, she already had a family.
And had, then you were born as a result of an affair with somebody who then...
What happened in Brixton.
Yes.
Yeah. And she was escaping from her husband at the time. I think even in Jamaica and the UK, domestic violence situations weren't really addressed by the police in a serious way. So she didn't know what to do, basically. She felt at a wit's end because she complained to the Jamaican police, she complained to the British police, but, you know, they turned a blind eye, you know. And so she felt it best for me that she give me up to my father to look after me because she was afraid of my life. My father struggled with me to the age of three, 1966. It was a struggle for him. It wasn't easy for a young man back then, especially one who didn't know the system. And so he gave me up to Lambeth Council in the summer of 1966.
Mm. Now, we've talked about the anger that you carried through, and your second novel, East of Acre Lane, dealt with the other big experience, possibly the seminal turning experience of your life, when you were jailed for sort of joining in too enthusiastically with the Brixton riots. Is that not the case?
Yes, it was the case. I guess you kind of get a herd mentality. You just follow the crowd and you're excited, adrenaline is rushing, and before you know it, there's a brick in your hand. And so, I was sentenced for that. I got just over a year. I went to Wormer Scrubs. But I was very fortunate because my cellmate was very well read, you know. And he, after a fight I had with him, he decided that I needed educating. And so he took me to the prison library. And the book he got out for me to learn my history was The Black Jacobins by the great C.L.R. James. And my reading wasn't that too clever back then, but he had one of those Collins dictionaries and he'd explain what the words meant that I couldn't understand. And so after that, I just flew, I flourished. I was so hungry to just gobble up books. I read the Harlem Renaissance writers, I read Langston Hughes, I read James Baldwin, and then I started to read European novels, even Jane Austen, Dickens. And it was a fantastic experience for me. For the first time in my life, I stopped feeling sorry for myself, because when you're reading about poor children living in the slums of Mumbai or what it was like in the descriptions that Pepys described in London a few hundred years ago, it makes you think, wow, you know, people survived that. So I've got no excuse for not surviving my life, if you like. And it taught me empathy. And so I always say when I go to schools that I try to encourage reading, because it does. You know, some of the bad experiences I had with bad boys and so on and bullies or whatever, I'm convinced that if literature was introduced to them early, they would have learned empathy and would become so violent.
And one of the features of your novels, possibly the sort of dominant feature, is your use of dialogue. And and those early novels were very much written in street slang of the day. And now it seems to me that one of the breakthroughs you've made with these YA novels is you've sort of liberated yourself from something which is very geo-specific and possibly difficult for people to understand or get with who don't know it, into an abstracted form of that. So you've created your own language in Crompton Nights and Little
I enjoyed that, because as you say, I was anchored by South London, especially in Brixton Rock, East of Acre Lane, a dirty South, and so I had to always be on that parallel, you know. Otherwise, if I did a reading in a South London school and I got some kind of a dialogue or diction wrong, they'd let me know about it. But I've created Crompton, so the rules are, there's no rules. I can create them myself. And that was the most enjoyable aspect of creating Crompton and a little bit in Crompton Nights. So I can be free with that. I'm not anchored to anything. I can just take what I can from anywhere. And I do. I borrow from film. I borrow from cartoons. I borrow from a phrase that a smart kid might have said in Plymouth, or a clever witticism from a smart girl in Norfolk or wherever. So I just put it all in, stir it in my pot and think, okay, will this work? Is this funny? Can the reader enjoy this? And I do want the readers to enjoy it, because sometimes I think when you're writing about bleak situations, the writer can become too worthy. Oh, this is a serious book, so it's got to be serious all the time. But no, I've taught in prisons and so on, and the bad is sort of bad, but they always can find something to laugh at. Because after all, it's entertainment. And you want people, whoever's going to read your books, to enjoy that experience. So I don't want them to hit them on the head all the time. I want them to give them a break. Oh, that made me laugh. Oh, that was funny. So they're going to turn the page even more. Yes, there are serious situations and scenarios in my work, but it's got to be, I've got to lace it with humour, because that's me as well. I mean, yes, I do have my dark moments. I do have my flashbacks to my youth and my childhood that disillusions me at times. But I can laugh. I can smile, as you know.
So it's as if you've sublimated yourself into your fiction. So it's not actually telling your story, but it is using, it's mining a very difficult period in your life.
Yeah.
Trying to make sense of it.
Because otherwise, I just get too depressed. You know, so it's quite healing for me. And, I mean, writing did release, I mean, I can vent, you know, whatever I can from my childhood now. And I can just infuse all that rage and agonies into characters.
And David Armand said of it, just in case we've made it sound worthy, it is not at all. It is hugely alive, your writing. And David Armand, who's one of the judges for the prize, said it hums with the beat of real life and the language sings from the page. I love this book. It's elegant, authentic and humane. This is mature, powerful writing by an author with great talent and great heart.
Incredible.
Could you have a better encomium?
No, I could not. I mean, I've admired him for years. So for him to write that, I was, wow. And he got it. It was meant to be funny. It was meant to be enjoyable. It was meant to be a great experience reading about Cronkton. So I'm very proud of that. Very, very proud of that. I mean, I was recording a radio show for BBC yesterday with Libby Purves, and she described Cronkton Nights as Woodhouse for the modern era. I thought, wow, I almost killed over. So that was lovely of her.
This Guardian podcast is sponsored by Squarespace. To find out more about how to set your website apart, head to squarespace.com/guardian.
One kitchen table I would love to sit around is the one belonging to the Spiegelmans. They are clearly a family that talk, that share, that write and rewrite their stories in the telling. Father of the family, Art Spiegelman, set the memoir ball rolling by interviewing his father Vladek about his experience as a Polish Jew surviving the Holocaust, a story Art immortalized in the graphic novel Mouse. His daughter Nadia turned to the women of the family to interview her mother and her grandmother and connect the often contradictory life narratives of the mothers who were once daughters themselves and whose shaping of family narrative reveals conflict, heartbreak, and searing love. Nadia came to The Guardian to speak with Claire, and she began with reading from I'm Supposed to Protect You from All This.
When I was a child, I knew that my mother was a fairy. Not the kind of fairy with gauzy wings and a magic wand, but one with a thrift store fur coat and ink-stained fingers. There was nothing she couldn't do. On weekends, she put on safety goggles, grabbed a jigsaw, and remade the cabinets in her bedroom. She ran a hose from her bathroom to the roof to fill my inflatable pool. She helped me build a diorama of the rainforest, carving perfect cardboard birds of paradise with her X-Acto blade. "Maman," I asked her when I was 4, "when will I be a fairy like you?" "When you're 16," she replied. And so I waited, and I watched her. Once, during a thunderstorm in Brazil, my mother pulled the rental car over to the side of the highway by a dark, deserted beach. She beckoned to my brother and me. We uncurled from the back seat and leapt out into the electric rain. We followed her, leaving my father shouting her name from the road, his voice barely carrying over the storm. We stripped down to our underwear. My mother held out her hands, one for each of us, and we ran straight into the water. The ocean picked us up again and slammed us down against the sand. We screamed with laughter. We ran back in. The sky fractured with lightning, opened, fell into the ocean. The waves reared twice as tall as my mother. At the car, my father was pale, his voice quiet with awe and anger. "Jesus, Françoise," he said, shaking his head. We were late now, as usual, and my mother drove the car fast down the highway toward the pitch-black sky. Though we had been in 2 accidents, I did not know my mother was a reckless driver until I was in my 20s, when friends told me so. The things my mother did not see about herself, I did not see either. We fell asleep in the back seat, my brother and I, mouths open, gritty with salt and sand, our hair drying in wild curls. My mother disdained most dangers as American constructs, invented by timid women who washed their vegetables. She was always certain that nothing would go wrong. "No one ever told me it was dangerous to swim in a lightning storm," she would say when I laughingly mentioned the memory years later. Her voice pitched defensively. She did not like to be teased. There were other vacations, too. The vacation when my mother, sick of the other moms who complained about the lack of apple juice at the breakfast buffet, absconded from the resort and let me drive the rented stick-shift Jeep along the dirt roads, even though my feet barely reached the pedals. The vacation when my mother booked no hotels in advance, just took off driving down the coast of Costa Rica, buying us all the strange fruits that they sold by the roadside. Once in a forest, my mother scooped the earth into her hand and put some in her mouth and ours while she explained about building immunities. We were often sick as children, and then rarely. We knew, my brother and I, that it was only fear that led to danger. My mother cast around us her conviction that we would always be safe, and it held us like a force field. Do you know when I finally felt free of my mother? My mother asked me. It was a story she told several times, more allegory than anecdote. I was a baby, 6 months old, and she'd taken me to France to meet her family. This was during the golden years, the ones I'll never remember, the years when she never put me down. She wore a big coat and me strapped underneath it. We shared a body. In the night, she woke and came to feed me before I'd even open my mouth to cry. But on this evening, when she arrived at her friend's home for a dinner party, she was instructed to leave me in the host's bedroom. She did so reluctantly. As food was served and wine glasses refilled, I began to cry. My mother leapt up from the table. "Leave her," the French friend said. "The noise doesn't bother us." My mother continued to move toward the door. "She'll never learn to stop crying if you pick her up each time," the friend said, with a tone of absolute authority the French often invoke when imparting wisdom. "You'll catch a cold if you go out with wet hair. Bread is more caloric when it's underbaked. You'll never sleep if you drink ginger tea in the evening." My mother hesitated, then sat back down. My wails grew louder. "She'll tire herself out," another friend declared. But my mother had already left the table again and gone to take me into her arms. As she soothed me, rocking me, pressing me to her body, she heard fragments of the chorus of disapproval from the other room. "Now the baby! When my child. She's just got to... It will only encourage her." This is what it would be like, my mother thought, as I quieted against her. This is what it would be if I raised her here. Everything would happen all over again. She thought of her loft in Manhattan with its high industrial ceilings. She thought of the streets where we were invisible, she and I, in the jostling Chinatown crowds. And she knew she was free. "I realized I could reinvent motherhood," she told me now. "I was so far from all this in America. I had no blueprint, no rules, and so I invented it, every piece. I had no idea what I was going to do, but I knew that it was going to be different." Now that I know her past, I saw both. I saw all the ways in which she worked to be a very different mother from her own, and I also saw how much the past, so long kept secret, pulled us into formations like a deep ocean current from so far below that we barely knew we were not moving on our own.
Well, that is the opening of I'm Supposed to Protect You from All This. And as you can hear from that, it's called a memoir, but it's actually a memoir of three generations. It's as if the memoir is collectively held within the consciousness of this grandmother, mother and daughter. And you're the daughter, Nadia.
Yes.
But we also have to remember the shadowy presence getting very angry in the car when your mother's putting you at risk, who is Art Spiegelman, who, as I'm sure listeners to this podcast will know, is a cartoonist and responsible particularly for the great graphic novel Mouse, in which he interviewed his father about Holocaust memories. And what you have done is you've inverted this because you have interviewed your mother and your grandmother about their memories. So it's a sort of huge familiar tribute all tangled up with who the tribute is actually to and who is the person who is overshadowing you.
Yes, absolutely.
So just tell us how it came to be.
Well, the part of it that had to do with needing to understand my mother came to be when I was a child and I'd ask her about her past. She would answer with, "I'll tell you when you're older, I'll tell you when you're older, I'll tell you when you're older." And then this one day when I was 21 years old and about to graduate from college, she did tell me a story about when she'd been young and vulnerable. And I'd had such an outsized admiration for my mother, but I didn't understand how she had become herself, and I didn't understand how to become a woman if she was what a woman was. And so I saw in that small moment of vulnerability this roadmap towards my own adulthood and understanding her path. And I asked her if I could be considered old enough to know, if she would be willing to tell me these things. And she thought about it really carefully, and when she decided to do it all the way, no holds barred, set one rule, which was, "I'll tell you everything up until the day I meet your father. There are some things you never need to know." But other than that, was willing to answer any question I could have. And it led to us becoming, when I was an adolescent, our relationship was fraught, as I think that many daughters' relationships with their mothers are during adolescence, as I think is healthy. But this process allowed us to achieve this kind of intense closeness that we'd had in the years I described that I don't remember before we learned to speak. I feel like we got to get back to that kind of symbiosis again. And simultaneously, she allowed me to see her as a girl and began to see me as an adult who was old enough to hear these stories. And so I think in a certain sense, we were able to pull each other out of ourselves and see each other as whole.
One of the complexities of this, and of which there are many, there's layer upon layer upon layer of sort of echoes and counterposed memories. One of the complexities is that your mother, Françoise, she dictated the frame in which she was willing to be seen. But in allowing her childhood to be seen, José, your grandmother, has no such rights. José, your grandmother, is wholly seen by you. How did you square that?
Oh, that's interesting, because I would actually see it the other way, simply because the kind of bond and kind of trust that my mother had with me was very different from what I'd established with my grandmother. And I feel like my mother was as honest with me about her past as most people are, only in their own thoughts or even rarely in their own thoughts. And so I felt like she gave me a more full ability to fully see her and all of her vulnerabilities. Whereas my grandmother, I hadn't known very well growing up, and it was only when I moved to France to get to know her for this project that we became close. And she is a very careful narrator of her own life and had a very specific way that she wanted to be seen. And so when she was telling me about her childhood, I actually felt like it was more framed and shaped than what I'd gotten from my mother.
But when it comes to their family life, your mother has very hostile memories of her mother, and the memories are in sharp contrast to each other. For example, tell the story of the lemon pie.
This was one of the stories my mum did tell me about when she was young, that she told several times, that she'd kept great bitterness about, which was when she was the middle of three daughters, and therefore the one who her father had staked his hopes upon being the son. He cut her hair short. She was supposed to become a doctor just like he was. And when she was about 13, she began to feel friction about that. Her older sister was the feminine one and therefore also the artistic, creative one who could cook. And she decided, my mother, that she was going to prove that she also knew how to cook. So she decided to announce to the family that she was going to make a lemon pie. And she got the lemons, she got the pie crust, she made the pie, and was teased mercilessly for it the entire time she was making it, as like, you wanted to poison us, we're going to die of hunger before you even get a chance to poison us. And when she brought the pie to the table, the family exploded in laughter because it was impossible to cut it, and her father joked that he was going to go get a chainsaw. And for her, this was a story then that her family retold many times, the terrible lemon pie Françoise once made. And for her, it really stayed with her as this moment of humiliation. But when I asked my grandmother about that same story, she said, but Françoise didn't tell you about the avalanche. And in her version of the story, at the very moment when they're trying to cut the pie, an avalanche breaks through the window and snow comes all the way up to their ankles at the table, and that's why the pie was never eaten. And that image of things being covered in snow, of there being this parts of our memory that simply gets whited out by the avalanche of the emotional humiliation, was really interesting to me.
There are a couple of times, and this is one of them, when you choose to believe your mother's story over your grandmother's story. And in the biggest area, the darkest area of the story, is about whether or not your grandfather was improper towards his daughter and towards you. Know that you had an experience with him where you felt uncomfortable, that he made some sort of sexual overtones to you when you were as young as 8. Mm-hmm. And José is convinced that that had happened to your mother. Your mother has no memory of it, or professes to have no memory of it.
Yeah, I believe my mother. I think in part because it's important to believe women in terms of what they say about what's happened to them in their bodies, and because we've had long conversations about it, and I believe her. I think I think that my grandmother had her own motivations for telling that story, that had to do with casting someone else as the villain in the past. And I also think that things aren't black and white, and that there's room for my grandfather to have not been clear on what boundaries were with all three of his daughters, including taking them to nightclubs when they were very young and saying, don't call me Papa, and so that people would think that somehow he had this beautiful young woman on his arm. without having crossed a very clear line into a black and white territory of having done something wrong.
And the thing that comes up every now and then is that they were living in a very different era. They were very glamorous. They were French. You've grown up in America. The standards by which behavior is judged is different in different eras and different places.
Yeah, absolutely. And even in terms of how these women, my mother and my grandmother, each respectively talked about the traumas that they have lived through, our generational differences in terms of how we perceived these things felt very strong. Like, for example, when my mother was telling me about an unwanted sexual encounter that she'd had with a man who she met, I reacted very strongly, wanting her to be angry about this, wanting her to acknowledge that it wasn't her fault, wanting her to follow these textbook feminism responses to what I saw as a sexual assault. And for her, it was really important to say, I take full responsibility. I shouldn't have gone to his house. I should have known better. I'm not going to give him the power over me to make me feel bad or to allow that to be a defining moment in my life, which I can understand. But similarly, when my grandmother was telling me about having had multiple abortions very early in each pregnancy, but because there wasn't another form of contraception available to her, she recounted those as being rather casual. And my mother, who had an abortion that she lived through as rather traumatic, found it really difficult to hear her mother talk about that so casually.
Running through this is the theme about who owns memories, whose memories are dominant in a shared space. And one of the peak moments is 9/11, when you're a high school girl in New York and you watch the towers coming down. And then your father draws it. And you say, my memories were so easily overwritten by his. They squared themselves away into comic book panels that contained pictures of me I had not even posed for. That is one hell of a statement.
It's interesting because people have asked, do you think that the fact that your father wrote about his family and turned his family into characters is part of what allowed you to do this with your own mother? And absolutely. I mean, I think that I grew up in a family where one set of grandparents was only available to me as a book. It wasn't a part of my life, a part of his life that my father wanted to talk about anymore. And so this fluidity between ourselves as selves and ourselves as characters and other people's narratives was always something that I was aware of.
You've written 3 graphic novels for children.
Yeah, they're very different kinds of projects because they were collaborations with artists who then drew. So I wrote a script and they fleshed it out into a fully drawn comic. And I loved doing those, but my true passion is for sort of more narrative work where I have a full authorial control.
Yeah, I was just wondering why it was how you'd happened upon this particular form to tell this story. And why did you not write it as a novel? Because in a way it is an intergenerational saga. It would have spared people.
Yeah, that's a question that my mother and my grandmother certainly asked. I think for me it was important. I mean, the most personal and selfish reason was because I felt I wanted to write, and I felt the shadow of my father's work very large over me. And so this was a way of, I felt like no matter what I did, it would be compared to a Pulitzer Prize winning book about the Holocaust, and that's a difficult place to start from. So this was a way of doing what he had done, but doing it completely differently and making it my own, and therefore making my name my own. But the other reason was that I think I wanted to explore this boundary between fiction and nonfiction, this idea that there are memories that can be honest without being true, and that we each have our own narratives, and that needed to start from a place of more or less nonfiction to go towards that interstitial space.
Yeah. Now, I was wondering about, so some of your descriptions of what happened to your mother at particular stages. For example, you say Françoise felt her chest fluttering like a hummingbird's. Mm-hmm. Did she use those words? Is that, where did those words come from, that formation of how she felt at that moment?
Some of it is language that she used, and some of it is my projection of how she may have felt in certain moments. But interestingly, the moments where I write about her as younger are the moments in which she recognizes herself the most in the book, even though they're the moments where I'm writing least from a sort of objectively journalistic text, because the moments that happen in the present tense between she and I am very much working off of recorded conversation, whereas the moments that go into a more narrative sense of the past, I'm at times using the words that she used and at times trying to imagine what it would have been like and be in that space. And yet she recognized herself in the descriptions of her childhood much more than she recognized herself in the present day scenes where she was viewed through my eyes.
She spoke French as a child, and this is written in English. Did you negotiate a language for it at all with her?
For the book?
Yeah, for her memories, for the way that her experience is recorded.
Well, we spoke, all of the interviews that I did were in French with my mother and my grandmother, and then in transcribing them, I transcribed them in English because I can only write in English. And that allowed there to already be a certain step of inserting myself as a narrator, because the language was being processed in sort of real time and changed into my own because I was translating it without being completely faithful to the specific nuances of each word.
And of course, the real way in which you make it your own is you have decided the form and the structure of the book. And it's fascinating the way what you have done is it's like you have made almost like your father's illustrative panels. You've done that with individual scenes, and you've put back to back scenes of your mother's childhood, scenes of your childhood in quite short bursts. So the interconnection is really intensely felt.
Yeah, that was what I was hoping, that there would be the sense of interconnection. But I also was hoping that in moving backwards through the generations and starting from my adolescence and going back to my mother's and then back to my grandmother's, there would also be this sense of pain diminishing as it flows downward. I mean, I guess as you read the book, it gets sort of bigger and bigger, but that there would be a sense that, like, my complaint that my mother had scolded me about opening a jar of milk that I hadn't opened would exist in context with my grandmother having lived through World War II.
Yeah, and this thing about food comes up again and again, and people blame each other. Their mothers are ashamed of their daughter's bodies, or they might not be, and the daughter might feel the mother's ashamed of her body, which is that's a really interesting thing that keeps echoing through the book.
Right, and actually that continues to be a point on which my mother and I don't agree. She says that she never had any issue with my body when I was a teenager, and for me it's one of the things I remember most about my adolescence. But part of writing this book was about leaving there the space for there to be my version of things and her version of things, and to allow them to coexist without needing to constantly be at war.
One of the most painful things for me as a mother and also as a daughter happens right at the beginning. It's where your mother says, "I love both my children equally." And you sort of assert that that wasn't your experience, that your experience was that she loved your brother more than she loved you, but also that that was borne out by friends of hers who took you aside and said, "This is not normal behaviour." And that is left as a sort of open thing. How does that sit in your family, that unresolved memory that you have? Does that make you emotional? You seem almost to be tearing up.
Yeah. I think there are the kinds of conversations I was able to have with my mother about her past also led to other private conversations that had to do with how our family had been formed and how she had felt about things that I had been unaware of. But as she'd placed the limits on, you can know everything up until the day I meet your father, there are things that are intentionally left out of the book, which might be strange because it is in some ways a very overly honest book that tackles a lot of difficult subjects. And then there are things that are very much left out of it and only alluded to.
But there is a lot of love in the book. I mean, yes. Obviously there are difficult things like that because that is the reality of family life. And that's one of the things that's so impressive about it, is it doesn't feel like you shirk those unanswerables in families, which we all know. You know, I've had that. I have a younger brother. I exactly know what you're talking about. I'm just interested that you can put it so clearly.
Yes.
And you love your grandmother. And does your mother love your grandmother now? Or do they? I mean, there's such hostility along the way.
My mother loves my grandmother very much. And it's actually something that I really admire. And one of the things that she said to me is, she said, "I decided to give myself the gift of a mother that I could love." And there's a moment when she decided to put her mother in her phone as Maman, even though she'd had her in her phone as José for years, and to decide to build a relationship in the present that that would be a strong one. And even before I began this project, actually, my mother and my grandmother spoke on the phone once a week, and that relationship, that new relationship that she'd formed only as an adult with her mother, is one that's incredibly important to her.
And it's partly been formed because of you helping it to happen. You're sort of midwifing the relationship between your mother and your grandmother, which is an extraordinary thing to do.
Well, they were already speaking before this book, but my mother had never known or thought to ask about my grandmother's past, and that's something that she discovered through my book that she's told me that she's really grateful for.
And have they read it?
Yes.
Both of them?
Yes.
And what do they think of it?
I think both of them would prefer to focus on our relationship than on their relationship to the book. They each have different reactions to it. My mother says that she needs to think about it as happening to some other little girl who just happens to share her name, because they're each very self-constructed women who have very strong narratives about themselves and their lives. And I don't think that it's easy for them to find themselves the subject of anyone else's work, much less their daughters or granddaughters. I hope that they can both see the amount of love that's in it, and I know that they both feel that the process of the project, the process of us spending all of these hours, I wrote this book over 7 years, the process of us having these conversations and exploring this difficult territory has brought us so much closer.
Has it closed something, or do you feel it is a staging post in a conversation that will continue?
I think it's the conversation that will continue, yeah.
And they're both still going. Your grandmother's still living on a boat.
Yes, she's still living on a
in
boat.
In Paris.
Still living on a houseboat in Paris. Still a fiery, tempestuous woman who I am really grateful to have gotten to know.
And we should say that your mother, having defied her father's expectations for her to become a doctor like him, became a very, very successful art director.
Yes.
In magazines in New York.
Yeah, my mom chooses the cover for The New Yorker magazine. I think she prefers to be called art director of The New Yorker magazine, but that is what she does. And I'm so, as well as publishing her own children's books, and I'm really proud of her.
I'm Supposed to Protect You from All This by Nadia Spiegelman is published by Riverhead Books. Alex Wheatle's Cronkton Nights is published by Atom Books. And the third volume of the trilogy, Straight Out of Cronkton, is coming out in April 2017. That's all for this week. Next week, we look at beautiful books and the beastly tales they reveal, with poet Ruth Padell and art historian Lucinda Hawksley. For more literary interviews, discussions, and live events, just search for Guardian Books Podcast. You can find us at theguardian.com, on iTunes, on SoundCloud, or on your smartphone. Just look for us via your favourite podcast app. But for now, from me, Sian Kane, and our producer, Susanna Trezillian, thank you and goodbye.
For more great downloads, go to theguardian.com/audio.